remember at the very end of last week's class, we were talking about the physical selecting of a king and some of the things that were laid out. The very last three points are going to be important as we begin to study the kings of the unified kingdom or the United Kingdom. The king was always going to be subject to God's authority. And most of the time that was going to come through the priest. Here, as we'll study tonight, Samuel will take a very large role in dealing with the consequences of the children of Israel's decision and having to deal with a king that went in wrong ways. Always subject to religious authority and approval throughout reign, God's representative could remove a king. And unfortunately, we'll find that right out of the gate is going to be required. And then the very third thing is that the people could revolt. So we talked about a king once they're in. Yes, they have a lot of power, they have a lot of authority, but there are some checks that are put in for the king of Israel to deal with. Kind of just to start out, because tonight if we get to all three of them, we're probably more familiar with these three stories than we are with a lot of what we've covered so far, the stories of Saul, David, and Solomon. As a leader, just from your personal experience and others that you've seen in leadership positions, as a leader, who is usually your biggest enemy? I think a lot of people would look in the mirror and say, sometimes we're our own biggest enemy as a leader. These three kings certainly faced large military threats. They faced threats from without, but we'll see for all three of them, the biggest threats came from within. It came from their heart. And it was a challenge to them, and some dealt with them, and some didn't deal with them, and we'll see different outcomes through that. One great thing about looking through and seeing these stories, they're great from a historical perspective, but when you put a spiritual lens on them, I think sometimes maybe we take for granted that the Bible really doesn't pull its punches when it's looking at its heroes. You know, in a lot of historical literature, the heroes are played up to be wonderful. The villains are played in a very bad light. You can see the editorial where it pushes one very clearly into one slide or the other one into the other. The Bible doesn't pull those punches. If it's got a hero, it looks at that hero through God's eyes and gives you a very honest assessment of who that man was in front of God. So it's interesting that we can look back and we also can see the truth in the Word of God, that it's presented with these men, both the good and the bad. So we go into Saul, the very first king, and you know, when you normally think of Saul, the very first connotation usually doesn't leave a good taste in your mouth, right? Because you know of what comes after. But do you remember how inconspicuous the choosing of Saul was? Look, if you've turned to 1 Samuel 9, let's look at Saul's response to being king, because I think it shows that there was a progression in this man, and he started out in actually a very good place. When Saul is found by Samuel, he's running errands for his father, looking for donkeys. I mean, talk about a very humble beginning. You don't get much more humble than that, right? You're out on an errand looking for these. And look in verse 21 when Samuel has talked to him about the possibilities. He says, "And Saul answered and said, 'Am I not a Benjamite? Of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin, then why do you speak like this to me?'" You see a humble guy. This is a guy with a humble heart. He doesn't understand what's being sat in front of him. So it shows that Saul came from a humble beginning. I mean, he's a humble man, apparently doing a very humble task. He is from a wealthy family. We do see that his father is well off and established. We also see the Bible go into detail about how handsome he was, that he had appearance that men would be drawn to him, that they would see him for an extra standout. Part of that was because he was tall. The Bible says that all men looked up to him, which is figurative probably as king, but literal because Saul stood head and shoulders above all the other men. From the tribe of Benjamin, do you remember last week when we talked about the civil war that took place at the end of Judges? Who was the instigator tribe at the end of Judges that had to basically be reined in by the rest of the tribes? It was these guys. Is it any mistake, perhaps, that Saul comes from the tribe of Benjamin? Remember what they did? What was the concern of Israel after that civil war? What had happened? They were worried that the tribe was going to disappear from Israel. Could there be some advantage in picking a king from the smallest tribe? There's no built-in army. He's not coming in with a ton of followers, so it's a fairly safe pick, potentially, to lead the children of Israel. Find a humble man from the smallest tribe and put him in with every advantage that you can think of putting him in for. So he started out humbly. And one thing to remember, too, is that Saul didn't pick this, which is also astounding as you look at him later on to see the failures that he made. But he was chosen by God. Look over in chapter 10. In verses 9 and 10, it says, "So it was, when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, that God gave him another heart. And all those signs came to pass that day. When they came there to the hill, there was a group of prophets to meet him, and the Spirit of God came upon him, and he prophesied among them." Saul didn't ask to be king. This was something that came to him because of God's will. And you see, interestingly, that God helps his heart to come toward this role of kingship. I'm reminded a lot of Moses, who was like, "Who am I to be the mouthpiece of your people?" I think we see a little bit of that same attitude in Saul. He's a military leader right off the bat. We see him really rise quickly in the history that we're presented, that he's really able to push back the Philistines, the Amalekites. So he rose really quick, but unfortunately, he falls just as quickly when things get going. What kind of leader blows up and throws a spear at one of his most trusted commanders? Attempts to kill his own son, his designated successor, in the middle of a conference. Customarily sits with his back to the wall so that nobody can do anything to him. He's that suspicious of others. And what kind of leader slaughters the inhabitants of an entire town because they've harbored someone who he perceives to be threatening his leadership? You can see that this heart doesn't last in Saul very long. He turns into what most of us would call a monster. I put on the bottom, you know, things that might be kind of correlating to that today. In a workplace, leader divides other people so that they can get their way. A leader or a boss who steals from the business that pays him or her, or a leader or a boss that threatens and abuses those under their supervision. You know, that top shows a leader that's lost their way, that's really gone to a place that's hard to recover from. So God rejects Saul. And the two instances that we always look at are the progression from 1 Samuel 13 to 1 Samuel 15. And really, if you look at 1 Samuel 13 in verses, really verse 8 is what I wanted to key in on. Saul had this victory, and at the end of the victory, look at verse 8. It says, "Then he waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him." And then verse 9, "So Saul said, 'Bring a burnt offering and a peace offering here to me.' And he offered the burnt offering, which the king could not do." That was only for Samuel to do. So Saul's test as a leader here was that he needed to wait. And as a leader, that's hard to do sometimes when you feel like you're unchecked, or if you've got power that is yours. So the challenge here was that he needed to wait on Samuel, and thus he needed to wait on the Lord. And I think there's a lesson in there for us. Sometimes patience and doing nothing can be the right answer. It's a hard answer because a lot of times as a leader, people look to you to be what? Action, 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 right? There's a lot of pressure when you're a leader to physically lead, to do something. People want to see activity when you're leading. But here, Samuel just needed to wait. He needed to be patient and do the right thing, but it was hard to be up in front of everybody, and the people were waiting on him, and he just wanted to go. He wanted to go, and he failed the test to wait on the Lord, which then, two more chapters over, the failure's even greater with the battle of the Amalekites. We've seen that he's been chastised by Samuel for what he did there at Gilgal. And then you see him go back out to destroy utterly the Amalekites. And we all are very familiar with the outcome of that story. He gets back. Samuel comes to him and says, "Why do I hear the bleating of sheep? Why have you not done what God commanded?" So we further see a failure on the part of Saul from not waiting on the Lord to just taking his own authority and disregarding what God had asked him to do. So I put this slide. What can we learn from a rejected leader? And I think these are things that we see as failures in Saul's life. He started humbly, but then he began to listen to his own good press. And that's something where we always talk about needing to have honest companions around us. Because what Saul had were a lot of men who kept pushing him on. Yes, 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 yes. And with kings, this was a particular problem. And this will be something that we see throughout the time of the divided kingdom, especially in Israel, as most of those kings didn't do well. We'll see if you don't surround yourself with wise companions, people that can give you good advice, you go down a path a lot of times that you don't really recognize that you're taking. He spoke foolishly with the potential to hurt his people and even his son. He was a bad leader with a quick mouth. And we see so much of the Bible talk about think first, then speak. And this was something that Saul particularly had a hard time with and really put others in harm's way because of it. He worried about what men thought rather than what God thought of him. And this really boils down to his failure with the Amalekites. He was worried about what the people were going to think if he didn't do it. He was also very quick to blame the people for his failures. So there was a relationship there in his mind that he was invested too much in what people thought and was worried about the attitudes that they had. And then he lost courage when he needed it the most. Remember the story where David is going to actually come on the scene and Saul's going to first take notice of him. Saul, as the king, should have been out there in front of Goliath, should he not? He at the very least, should have had more courage. But here you saw a man of God's own heart, David, who had the courage where Saul did not, where Saul failed. Jealousy is going to devour Saul's heart. As we move through his kingship, David is going to very apparently become a rival to him. And just to follow that up, he eventually thought of God's servants as his enemies. It's a sad place when God anoints you as his first king, and eventually you wind up thinking of God's servants as those that are your direct enemies. Any kind of godly advice, you're going to put it directly in the opposition category, and that's exactly what Saul does over the course of his reign. I think it's interesting that we only have one recorded time in Saul's reign where he felt compelled to apologize for what he had done, where he confessed his wrongs. Let's go over and look at that really quickly at 1 Samuel 15. In verses 24 and 25, this is obviously after the failure with the Amalekites to destroy them all. And Samuel basically says, the kingdom is going to be taken away from you. And then Saul says to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord. For everything else that Saul didn't do right, we don't have any kind of a confession of that wrong. We don't have any kind of a repentant heart for any of that wrong. So we really see a person that's unrepentant in the way that they're going. And he relied on the counsel of the world. At the very end, he actually has a very deep split with Samuel where he's not asking the man of God for advice. He no longer wants to hear. And that, again, is going to be something that echoes throughout our study this entire quarter. It's when you decide that God is an enemy, you go down a very different path with very different results. Just a thought question here. As we've seen, Saul had a very public and very painful fall. What are some of the consequences when a leader falls? It's never an isolated event, is it, where it just affects a leader? Sir? Absolutely. And it's never just where it affects the palace and that's it, right? It's just affecting that one man. When Saul fell, it had deep-seated consequences throughout the kingdom of Israel. And things that we're going to see as cracks that add up over time, that it wasn't just Saul that was affected, it was the entire kingdom. I found a quote that I liked that applies, I think, to Saul, but our work as the church as well. The quote is, our greatest fear as individuals and as a church should not be a failure, but of succeeding in things in life that don't really matter. And when I saw that, I had to think about it for a minute. Our greatest fear as individuals in a church should not be a failure, but of succeeding in things in life that don't really matter. That's exactly what happened to Saul, isn't it? He had all the glory. He had military might. He had success. But the one place he didn't have success was where? Was in the most important relationship that he could have had. And I think that that quote and seeing this example is profound for us. There are a lot of things in this world that we can get tied up in that feel good to us because they're success. They're things that we've done that we feel good about, that we take pride in, that we spend time on. But if you lose sight of the biggest goal there, it might actually be that some failure would be good for us because we're succeeding in things that don't really make long-term effects. So Saul is now rejected and out. So some of the things that we see when Saul leaves, for the third time, we're not going to see power handed down to one of the sons. And that was the way it was designed when this was set up, that there would be a member. But for the third time, that's not going to work exactly right. Saul is going to be given a distressing spirit from God because of the way his heart has gone. God actually sits this distressing spirit on him and causes great, great tribulation in David as the next king arises. He refused to see that God had passed on his favor for another. Remember we talked about how kings were never going to let power go? Saul saw that in David. I mean, it would have taken a blind man to not see that this man had the favor of God. And once he recognized that, it wasn't even a check to his ego, where you at least could have seen, and God had already told him that the kingdom was no longer going to be his. But he refused to even acknowledge that and went after David accordingly. So Saul's in. He died with most of his family on the same day on the battlefield. They're wiped out almost all together. And we see that Saul goes from this self-depreciating man who seems like he would be a really good candidate for the first king of Israel to this man at the very end who he wants nothing but glory for him. He wants no glory for God. The failure with the Amalekites says Saul wanted to be the man, and he wanted Israel to know that he was the man. And that position was always God's. But there you see the words of Samuel coming into play immediately. That the kings were going to be about themselves and have that temptation. And here we clearly see that God is going to make sure that his leader walks with him. You can't take a divergent path because God will cause things to happen that will take that authority away from you. Any comments on that before we move on to the next one? Brian? Yeah, it made me think a little bit too. You know, you've got two men that I think of when you talk about rash speech. You've got Saul, and then I think of Peter too. But you see different hearts in them, in that Peter was always willing to come back from where he had made mistakes. And you see, especially I think in 2 Peter, that growth that's taken place in his life. You don't ever see that with Saul. You see him till the very end. You know, what he thinks is what comes right out of his mouth. And unfortunately, they weren't good things. We just get an honest peer right into his soul, and it's not good. Like,
to remind us, this is exactly what God told his prophet. What happened is they wanted a king, and they want one, and I give them one. Here's what's going to happen. First king, you put a checklist together. Here's what God said, here's what he did.
Yeah. And to the question earlier with what Sarah was saying, do you ever wonder what the children of Israel thought when Saul was falling apart? Do you ever think they thought, well, what's next? You know, are we going to find another one? What are we going to do? Because this had just been established for them, and God had picked Saul. You know, it really had to cause a lot of anxiety on the part of the children of Israel to say, okay, well, Saul has failed, and now he's died on the battlefield, and all of his family has died with him. What comes next? So this is not an easy transition for the people either to go through the conditions that have happened. So now we move on to David, who is really the benchmark of all the kings. And it's sad that we hit the benchmark right here on week 3, right? Because from here on out, you go down. There's nowhere to go but down. And just looking at some things that are said about David, 1 Samuel 16, he was not the most impressive of Jesse's sons. Samuel again has the task of going to the household of Jesse, and he sees a son, and he's like, okay, that's the one, right? And God's like, nope, that's not the right one. So here we see a little bit of a departure, that it's not Samuel's thinking of who's going to be that next king, but God has a plan for what he wants out of his next leader. Where was David when Samuel went to visit Jesse's home? Do you remember? Tending the sheep. So we see that he was handsome in appearance, but he was a shepherd. And that made me think, you know, a shepherd is going to be, you know, he's going to be out there. He's not going to be fair. It reminded me a little bit maybe of Esau, because he was out always doing the things outdoors. So we know that he was handsome, but he was a shepherd. What kind of heart does a shepherd have? And we see a little bit of that glimpse into Saul's heart, but this is where the emphasis really changes, and we see what God wants out of his leader. A shepherd's heart is caring by nature. It's looking after a helpless sheep, a flock of sheep. It's self-sacrificial. What wouldn't the shepherd do to keep those sheep safe and to guide them in the right ways? That was courageous. We find out that David fought many, many, many threats as he talks about going up against Goliath. He had fought for those sheep to keep them safe. It was faithful and loyal. He was out there at the charge of his father to take care of those. And sheep would have been part of his father's estate. They would have been part of his wealth. So this was something that he had entrusted David to do, and David did it well. And it's a humble beginning, isn't it? You can't get much more humble than, you know, going after your dad's donkeys as Saul, and then you're out tending sheep as David. So we see a very humble beginning. And I liked a quote that I saw about shepherd. Being a shepherd, it's a shepherd is out guarding and guiding the dumbest of all the mammals to make sure they're safe. You know, because sheep are not an intelligent lot, and I think that was probably God trying to tell us something as flock ourselves. But it was a big responsibility, but it took a special kind of person to do that and do that right and do it well. And we see that echoed in the guidance for shepherds as our leaders in the New Testament as well. So we see David referred to as a man after God's own heart. And this is what David showed the people of Israel. And I love that we have the Psalms to go back in and see David's heart in his own words, because you get to see that picture of who he was and how strongly he felt about being first a child of God and then God's ruler of his people. I just put up a couple of references in the different Psalms, but he showed Israel how to worship with his heart. We see more of that than we see in any other of God's leaders about really showing the people how to turn their hearts to God. We also see him talk about how to be confident in God after failure, and we're going to see that very painfully in his life. But it's something that a leader shows. You have to show your weak spots, and you also have to show your strong spots. But he led in both, where Saul didn't lead in both. He showed that God is sovereign. He showed that he would protect and direct his flock. Obedience was at the heart of who David was. And we see that in a lot of different things, but let's look really quickly at Psalms 46 through 8, just to show you some of the things that I picked out to illustrate. I don't have time to go through them all, but Psalms 46 through 8. And there's so many things that we use to direct our hearts and minds to worship that David wrote in these Psalms. So if you think about how many good things we have, it's really easy to pick out from what he wrote. But look at Psalms 40, verse 6. Sacrifice and offering you did not desire. My ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you did not require. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart. So you see from David's own words, this was the kind of man that God was choosing to lead his people. He was courageous in the way that he fought his battles. David was not one to sit back in the palace when there was a battle going on. Certainly he had his mighty men that would go out and fight for him, but we see David as one of those men that was very courageous from his very earliest beginnings, that he trusted in God and he went out with God's reassurance in his battles. And to the point that we were talking about with Saul, we see David as somebody that's very careful and thoughtful in their words. David is not somebody that fires off the hip like Saul did. He's very careful, and he thinks about what he's saying before he does that, and he's going to be much better for Israel because of the way he does that. And once you look at David's kingship, our focus for that is going to be the legacy that he leaves, correct? He's of the tribe of Judah, which was one of the largest of the tribes. So we go from Benjamin to Judah, but we're going to see a kingly legacy passed down through that tribe. The kingship was passed down through his lineage, but it's not without controversy, something that would have been easy, should have been easy. Even for a good king, it was not going to be simple to do for him. David's failures, they remind us that consequences follow godly people after sin. And I think that's one thing that we see through this very public failure of David, is that even through a good heart, sometimes there are consequences, and they follow, and they can be long-lasting. And when I say that, I think you're going to see them decades, if not centuries down the line, because of the effects of some of the things that David did. He established the city of Jerusalem, which is a big deal. Up to this point, you know, we had talked about how there were really small cities scattered all throughout the Promised Land. Well, for the first time, David's going to pull together Jerusalem, and that's going to become a really important stepping stone, especially for Solomon as he moves forward. Since violence was attached to David's life, he wasn't given the privilege of building the temple. How strongly did David's heart want to build that temple for God? That was what he wanted to do. In a lot of senses, he was the right man to do it, but because violence was in his violence and bloodshed was in his legacy, God denied him the ability to do that. And then, unfortunately, we're going to see that his family learns from him and sees a lot of those weaknesses and is going to carry a lot of those weaknesses forward. And that's really painful for us too, isn't it? Because as we're living and we see things that we wish we did better, I think one of the greatest fears we have as parents is, what am I going to give to my children that I don't want to give to my children? And that's something that I think each of us deal with. Some of those things we can't help, as a funny side note. But the things that we can help, because I think that would be something that David would have changed. As much as he loved the Lord, he never would have wanted to see his family have the issues that they did because of what he did. Put a couple of pictures in here. I don't know about you, but when I think of Jerusalem, even in the time of David, I'm thinking this sprawling metropolis that's just gigantic. And this is just a good check for us. This is what Jerusalem looked like in the time of David. It was relatively small. During the reign of David, he actually went into the city and took it. You can see at the very top, I know the letters are small, but at the very, very top is the Palace of David. So right there at the top of the hill, and that's going to be something that's interesting to me, is that every royal palace in any kingship that we're going to study this quarter is built at the topmost point of the city. Everybody else has to look up to see the palace. And it's just interesting to me. I mean, obviously it would have had military advantages too, but it's interesting to see that that's going to be common throughout every single kingdom that we study, is the palace is built on the top of the hill, and everybody else lives underneath the shadow of that palace. Talking about the transition from David to Solomon. Transition is never going to be easy, and that's something that we're going to see in this study of the kingdom, is that the passing of power from one man to the next man is uniformly ugly. It is never done well, and it's never done in a peaceful way. There's always somebody to throw something into the mix that makes it really difficult. David had difficulty even himself letting go of his power and authority. When we see him finally talking to Solomon, he's basically gone. He's lost a lot of his mental facilities. I mean, he's bedridden, it looks like. I mean, he's really past the point of governing and being present in what he needed to do. So we even see David not wanting to let go of his position. So what happens is he has a son that decides he wants to have that power. And it's really interesting that Adonijah is one of his older sons, and Adonijah is also the brother of whom? Does anybody know? He's the brother of Absalom. Big surprise, right? So we get a picture of how radical you get from one end of David's sons to the other end of David's sons. Because he's already lost one son that was trying to usurp the throne, essentially. And here Adonijah sees his father is old and is beginning to lose his grasp on the kingdom. So he says, it's my turn, and I'm going to take it. We see in 1 Kings 1:5, the Bible uses the phrase, Adonijah exalted himself. You don't want to exalt yourself in this process. You have to have God as being the one that exalts you. So he rises up and makes a claim, and I think the story behind the intervention is really interesting. Bathsheba and Nathan work kind of hand in hand to basically restore David's intentions to give the kingdom to Solomon. He had already promised that to Bathsheba previously. So Bathsheba was very well aware, but it's really interesting to me that you have two, I think, good people working for good reasons, because you have Nathan the prophet that works with Bathsheba to basically rescue this kingdom from going to Adonijah, because Adonijah at this point was actually already proclaiming himself king, and they were having a ceremony to basically rejoice about Adonijah's coronation when this occurs. But this occurs, and they basically get David to reaffirm, and Solomon is basically anointed as king at this point. This is going to be a pattern in the divided kingdom that we see many, many times over. Something that made me think at this point, we see a lot in Peter and Paul's books toward the end of their lives. What happens when leadership is absent in a group of God's people, even for a very short amount of time? What do we see as warnings when leadership is absent? Everything just goes on cruise control, right? It's a really easy question, but I think it's perfectly shown to us here with Adonijah's actions. When you have any kind of a lull in leadership, there are going to be men that see that as an opportunity. And if you look in 2 Timothy and 2 Peter, the motivations behind these men are uniform. They're almost exactly the same. These men want power for themselves, but they're also going to do it with what kind of teaching? False teaching, usually, because they're trying to gather people to themselves and not necessarily to God. So there's a warning in here for us today that leadership can't go in a vacuum. There's no amount of time that's going to be safe for there not to be good leadership in place before things start to go wrong. Let's skip through that one. From father to son. So when David is passing this off to Solomon, does anybody know, and it caused me to do a little bit of study, does anybody know how old Solomon was when he became king? I had to look too. There's actually a little bit of controversy about it because there's a range. It depends on who you look at. Because of the dating of how old Rehoboam was when he became king at 41, there's a good chance, because Solomon reigned for 40 years, so that's going to put Rehoboam at 1 year old when Solomon went in as king. There are some authors that say as early as 12, which I just kind of dropped my jaw because I was like, I don't ever remember thinking Solomon was that young when he became king, but most people do say probably in the early 20s range, maybe at 20, which is a little bit, I mean, that stood out to me. I don't know that I remembered Solomon being that young, but you're also going to see, Laura and I were talking about it, and she's like, well, it makes a lot more sense that Bathsheba would have to act so strongly to get Solomon put in if Solomon's a younger man, that maybe, you know, he couldn't take as full of an action, and that makes a little bit of sense to me, but we see Solomon going in at age 20. So like Joash and a couple of other kings, we're seeing a very early trial period. I don't know that I would want to be king at 41. I don't know that I would want to be king at 61. But here Solomon is thrust into this role at probably an early age, if not 20, then maybe just a few years after. Think about where you were at 20 and the challenges that you had just with your mind and learning who you were and learning what you weren't. And now you're going to be the king of Israel as your father dies and goes on. Let's look, if we get time, let's turn over to 1 Kings 2, 2 through 4. Because it's a very poignant speech that David gives to his son. You can see the love that he has for his son. He says, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man. And keep the charge of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn. You see what David wants, the very first thing. He wants Solomon to hold on to the Lord. He's learned his lessons, and he's a man of God, and he's seen what happens to those that aren't men of God. And you see the great love that he wants Solomon to first be a man of God, because that will make him a good king. We'll pick up here next week and continue our study.